Dr. No by Ian Fleming continued. Disc 5. And I would like a medium vodka dry martini with a slice of lemon peel. Shaken and not stirred, please. I would prefer Russian or Polish vodka. Dr. No gave his thin smile an extra crease. I see you are also a man who knows what he wants. On this occasion your desires will be satisfied. Do you not find that it is generally so? When one wants a thing, one gets it. That is my experience. The small things. If you fail at the large things, it means you have not large ambitions. Concentration, focus, that is all. The aptitudes come, the tools forge themselves. Give me a fulcrum and I will move the world, but only if the desire to move the world is there. The thin lips bent minutely downwards in deprecation. But this is chatter. We are making conversation. Instead, let us talk. Both of us, I am sure, prefer talk to conversation. Is the martini to your liking? You have cigarettes? Enough, and the right sort to cosset your cancer? So be it. Sam, put the shaker beside the man and another bottle of Coca-Cola beside the girl. It should now be 8:10. We will have dinner at 9 o'clock, precisely. Dr. No sat slightly more upright in his chair. He inclined himself forward, staring at Bond. There was a moment's silence in the room. Then Dr. No said, "And now, Mr. James Bond of the Secret Service, let us tell each other our secrets. First, to show you that I hide nothing, I will tell you mine. Then you will tell me yours." Dr. No's eyes blazed darkly. "But let us tell each other the truth." He drew one steel claw out of the wide sleeve and held it upwards. He paused. "I shall do so. But you must do the same. If you do not, these," he pointed the claw at his eyes, "will know that you are lying." Dr. No brought the steel claw delicately in front of each eye and tapped the center of each eyeball. Each eyeball, in turn, emitted a dull ting. "These," said Dr. No, "see everything." Chapter 15. Pandora's Box. James Bond picked up his glass and sipped at it thoughtfully. It seemed pointless to go on bluffing. His story of representing the Audubon Society was anyway a thin one, which could be punctured by anyone who knew about birds. It was obvious that his own cover was in shreds. He must concentrate on protecting the girl. To begin with, he must reassure her. Bond smiled at Dr. No. He said, "I know about your contact in King's House, Miss Tarrow. She is your agent. I have recorded the fact, and it will be divulged in certain circumstances." Dr. No's expression showed no interest. "As will other facts. But if we are to have a talk, let us have it without any more stage effects. You are an interesting man, but it is not necessary to make yourself more interesting than you are. You have suffered the misfortune of losing your hands. You wear mechanical hands. Many men wounded in the war wear them. You wear contact lenses instead of spectacles. You use a walkie-talkie instead of a bell to summon your servant. No doubt you have other tricks, but, Dr. No, you are still a man who sleeps and eats and defecates like the rest of us. So no more conjuring tricks, please. I am not one of your guano diggers, and I am not impressed by them." Dr. No inclined his head a fraction. "Bravely spoken, Mr. Bond. I accept the rebuke. I have no doubt developed annoying mannerisms from living too long in the company of apes. But do not mistake these mannerisms for bluff. I am a technician. I suit the tool to the material. I possess also a range of tools for working with refractory materials. However," Dr. No raised his joined sleeves an inch and let them fall back in his lap, "let us proceed with our talk. It is a rare pleasure to have an intelligent listener, and I shall enjoy telling you the story of one of the most remarkable men in the world. You are the first person to hear it. I have not told it before. You are the only person I have ever met who will appreciate my story. And also—" Dr. No paused for the significance of the last words to make itself felt. "Keep it to himself," he continued. "The second of these considerations also applies to the girl." So that was it. There had been little doubt in Bond's mind, ever since the Spandau had opened up on them, And since, even before then, in Jamaica, where the attempts on him had not been half-hearted. Bond had assumed from the first that this man was a killer, that it would be a duel to the death. He had had his usual blind faith that he would win the duel, all the way until the moment when the flamethrower had pointed at him. Then he had begun to doubt. Now he knew. This man was too strong, too well-equipped. Bond said, "There is no point in the girl hearing this. She has nothing to do with me. I found her yesterday on the beach. She is a Jamaican from Morgan's Harbour. She collects shells. Your men destroyed her canoe, so I had to bring her with me. Send her away now and then back home. She won't talk. She will swear not to." The girl interrupted fiercely.
"I will talk. I shall tell everything. I'm not going to move. I'm going to stay with you."
Bond looked at her. He said icily, "I don't want you." Dr. No said softly, "Do not waste your breath on these heroics. Nobody who comes to this island has ever left it. Do you understand? Nobody. Not even the simplest fisherman. It is not my policy. Do not argue with me or attempt to bluff me. It is entirely useless." Bond examined the face. There was no anger in it, no obstinacy. Nothing but a supreme indifference. He shrugged his shoulders. He looked at the girl and smiled. He said, "All right, honey, and I didn't mean it. I'd hate you to go away. We'll stay together and listen to what the maniac has to say." The girl nodded happily. It was as if her lover had threatened to send her out of the cinema, and now had relented. Dr. No said, in the same soft, resonant voice, "You are right, Mr. Bond. That is just what I am, a maniac. All the greatest men are maniacs. They are possessed by a mania which drives them forward towards their goal. The great scientists, the philosophers, the religious leaders, all maniacs. What else but a blind singleness of purpose could have given focus to their genius, would have kept them in the groove of their purpose? Mania, my dear Mr. Bond, is as priceless as genius. Dissipation of energy, fragmentation of vision, loss of momentum, the lack of follow-through, these are the vices of the herd." Dr. No sat slightly back in his chair. "I do not possess these vices. I am, as you correctly say, a maniac. A maniac, Mr. Bond, with a mania for power. That," the black holes glittered blankly at Bond through the contact lenses, "is the meaning of my life. That is why I am here. That is why you are here. That is why here exists." Bond picked up his glass and drained it. He filled it again from the shaker. He said, "I'm not surprised. It's the old business of thinking you're the King of England, or the President of the United States, or God. The asylums are full of them. The only difference is that instead of being shut up, you've built your own asylum and shut yourself up in it. But why did you do it? Why does sitting shut up in this cell give you the illusion of power?" Irritation flickered at the corner of the thin mouth. "Mr. Bond, power is sovereignty. Clausewitz's first principle was to have a secure base. From there one proceeds to freedom of action. Together, that is sovereignty. I have secured these things and much besides. No one else in the world possesses them to the same degree. They cannot have them. The world is too public. These things can only be secured in privacy. You talk of kings and presidents. How much power do they possess? As much as their people will allow them. Who in the world has the power of life or death over his people? Now that Stalin is dead, can you name any man except myself? And how do I possess that power, that sovereignty? Through privacy. Through the fact that nobody knows. Through the fact that I have to account to no one." Bond shrugged. "That is only the illusion of power, Dr. No. Any man with a loaded revolver has the power of life and death over his neighbor. Other people beside you have murdered in secret and got away with it. In the end, they generally get their deserts. A greater power than they possess is exerted upon them by the community. That will happen to you, Dr. No. I tell you, your search for power is an illusion because power itself is an illusion." Dr. No said equably, "So is beauty, Mr. Bond. So is art. So is money. So is death. And so, probably, is life. These concepts are relative. Your play upon words does not shake me. I know philosophy, I know ethics, and I know logic better than you do, I dare say. But let us move away from this sterile debate. Let us return to where I began, with my mania for power, or, if you wish it, for the illusion of power. And please, Mr. Bond, again the extra crease in the fixed smile, please do not imagine that half an hour's conversation with you will alter the pattern of my life. Interest yourself rather in the history of my pursuit, let us put it, of an illusion. Go ahead. Bond glanced at the girl. She caught his eye. She put her hand up to her mouth as if to conceal a yawn. Bond grinned at her. He wondered when it would amuse Dr. No to crack her pose of indifference. Dr. No said benignly, I shall endeavour not to bore you. Facts are so much more interesting than theories, don't you agree? Dr. No was not expecting a reply. He fixed his eye on the elegant tulip shell that had now wandered halfway up the outside of the dark window. Some small silverfish squirted across the black void. A bluish prickle of phosphorescence meandered vaguely. Up by the ceiling the stars shone more brightly through the glass. The artificiality of the scene inside the room, the three people sitting in the comfortable chairs, the drinks on the sideboard, the rich carpet, the shaded lights, suddenly seemed ludicrous to Bond. Even the drama of it, the danger, were fragile things compared with the progress of the tulip shell up the glass outside. Supposing the glass burst. Supposing the stresses had been badly calculated, the workmanship faulty. Supposing the sea decided to lean a little more heavily against the window. Dr. No said, I was the only son of a German Methodist missionary and a Chinese girl of good family. I was born in Peking, but on what is known as the wrong side of the blanket. I was an encumbrance. An aunt of my mother was paid to bring me up. Dr. No paused. No love, you see, Mr. Bond. Lack of parental care. He went on. The seed was sown. I went to work in Shanghai. I became involved with the Tongs, with their illicit proceedings. I enjoyed the conspiracies, the burglaries, the murders, the arson of insured properties. They represented revolt against the father figure who had betrayed me. I loved the death and destruction of people and things. I became adept in the technique of criminality, if you wish to call it that. Then there was trouble. I had to be got out of the way. The Tongs considered me too valuable to kill. I was smuggled to the United States. I settled in New York. I had been given a letter of introduction in code to one of the two most powerful Tongs in America, the Hip Sings. I never knew what the letter said, but they took me on at once as a confidential clerk. In due course, at the age of 30, I was made the equivalent of treasurer. The treasury contained over $1 million. I coveted this money. Then began the great Tong wars of the late 20s. The two great New York Tongs, my own, the Hip Sings, and our rival, the On Lee Ongs, joined in combat. Over the weeks, hundreds of both sides were killed, and their houses and properties burned to the ground. It was a time of torture and murder and arson in which I joined with delight. Then the riot squads came. Almost the whole police force of New York was mobilized. The two underground armies were prized apart, and the headquarters of the two Tongs were raided, and the ringleaders sent to jail. I was tipped off about the raid on my own Tong, the Hip Sings. A few hours before it was due, I got to the safe and rifled the $1 million in gold and disappeared into Harlem and went to ground. I was foolish. I should have left America, gone to the farthest corner of the earth. Even from the condemned cells in Sing Sing, the heads of my Tong reached out for me. They found me. The killers came in the night. They tortured me. I would not say where the gold was. They tortured me all through the night. Then, when they could not break me, they cut off my hands to show that the corpse was that of a thief, and they shot me through the heart and went away. But they did not know something about me. I am the one man in a million who has his heart on the right side of his body. Those are the odds against it. One in a million. I lived. By sheer willpower, I survived the operation and the months in hospital. And all the time I planned and planned how to get away with the money, how to keep it, what to do with it. Dr. No paused. There was a slight flush at his temples. His body fidgeted inside his kimono. His memories had excited him. For a moment he closed his eyes, composing himself. Bond thought, now. Shall I leap at him and kill him? Break off my glass and do it with a jagged stem? The eyes opened. I am not boring you? You are sure? For an instant I felt your attention wandering. No, the moment had passed. Would there be others? Bond measured the inches of the leap, noted that the jugular vein was in full view above the neck of the kimono. The thin purple lips parted, and the story went on. It was, Mr. Bond, a time for clear, firm decisions. When they let me out of the hospital, I went to Silberstein, the greatest stamp dealer in New York. I bought an envelope, just one envelope, full of the rarest postage stamps in the world. I took weeks to get them together. But I didn't mind what I paid. In New York, London, Paris, Zurich, I wanted my gold to be mobile. I invested it all in these stamps. I had foreseen the world war. I knew there would be inflation. I knew the best would appreciate, or at least hold its value. And meanwhile, I was changing my appearance. I had all my hair taken out by the roots, my thick nose made thin, my mouth widened, my lips sliced. I could not get smaller, so I made myself taller. I wore built-up shoes. I had weeks of traction on my spine. I held myself differently. I put away my mechanical hands and wore hands of wax inside gloves. I changed my name to Julius No, the Julius after my father, and the No for my rejection of him and of all authority. I threw away my spectacles and wore contact lenses, one of the first pairs ever built. Then I went to Milwaukee, where there are no Chinamen, and enrolled myself in the Faculty of Medicine. I hid myself in the academic world, the world of libraries and laboratories and classrooms and campuses, and there, Mr. Bond, I lost myself in the study of the human body and the human mind. Why? Because I wished to know what this clay is capable of. I had to learn what my tools were before I put them to use on my next goal— total security from physical weaknesses, from material dangers, and from the hazards of living. Then, Mr. Bond, from that secure base, armored even against the casual slings and arrows of the world, I would proceed to the achievement of power. The power, Mr. Bond, to do unto others what had been done unto me. The power of life and death, the power to decide, to judge, the power of absolute independence from outside authority. For that, Mr. Bond, whether you like it or not, is the essence of temporal power. Bond reached for the shaker and poured himself a third drink. He looked at Honeychild. She seemed composed and indifferent, as if her mind was on other things. She smiled at him. Dr. No said benignly, I expect you are both hungry. Pray be patient, I will be brief. So, if you recall, there I was in Milwaukee. In due course, I completed my studies, and I left America and went by easy stages round the world. I called myself doctor, because doctors receive confidences, and they can ask questions without arousing suspicion. I was looking for my headquarters. It had to be safe from the coming war. It had to be an island. It had to be entirely private, and it had to be capable of industrial development. In the end, I purchased Crab Key, and here I have remained for 14 years. They have been secure and fruitful years, without a cloud on the horizon. I was entertained by the idea of converting bird dung into gold, and I attacked the problem with passion. It seemed to me the ideal industry. There was a constant demand for the product. The birds require no care except to be left in peace. Each one is a simple factory for turning fish into dung. The digging of the guano is only a question of not spoiling the crop by digging too much. The sole problem is the cost of the labor. It was 1942. The simple Cuban and Jamaican laborer was earning 10 shillings a week cutting cane. I tempted 100 of them over to the island by paying them 12 shillings a week. With guano at $50 a ton, I was well placed, but on one condition, that the wages remained constant. I ensured that by isolating my community from world inflation. Harsh methods have had to be used from time to time, but the result is that my men are content with their wages because they are the highest wages they have ever known. I brought in 12 Chinese Negroes, with their families, to act as overseers. They receive £1 a week per man. They are tough and reliable. On occasion I had to be ruthless with them, but they soon learned. Automatically my people increased in numbers. I added some engineers and some builders. We set to work on the mountain. Occasionally I brought in teams of specialists on high wages. They were kept apart from the others. They lived inside the mountain until their work was done and then left by ship. They put in the lighting and the ventilation and the lift. They built this room. Stores and furnishings came in from all over the world. These people built the sanatorium facade which will cover my operations in case one day there is a shipwreck or the governor of Jamaica decides to pay me a call. The lips glazed into a smile. You must admit that I am able, if I wish, to accord visitors a most fragrant reception, a wise precaution for the future. And gradually, methodically, my fortress was built while the birds defecated on top of it. It has been hard, Mr. Bond. The black eyes did not look for sympathy or praise. But by the end of last year the work was done. A secure, well-camouflaged base had been achieved. I was ready to proceed to the next step, an extension of my power to the outside world. Dr. No paused. He lifted his arms an inch and dropped them again resignedly in his lap. Mr. Bond, I said that there was not a cloud in the sky during all these 14 years, but one was there all the time, below the horizon. And do you know what it was? It was a bird, a ridiculous bird called a roseate spoonbill. I will not weary you with the details, Mr. Bond. You are already aware of some of the circumstances. The two wardens, miles away in the middle of the lake, were provisioned by launch from Cuba. They sent out their reports by the launch. Occasionally, ornithologists from America came by the launch and spent some days at the camp. I did not mind. The area is out of bounds to my men. The wardens were not allowed near my compounds. There was no contact. From the first I made it clear to the Audubon Society that I would not meet their representatives. And then what happens? One day, out of a clear sky, I get a letter by the monthly boat. The roseate spoonbills have become one of the bird wonders of the world. The Society gives me formal notification that they intend to build a hotel on their leasehold near the river up which you came. Bird lovers from all over the world will come to observe the birds. Films will be taken. Crab Key, they told me in their flattering, persuasive letter, would become famous. Mr. Bond. The arms were raised and dropped back. Irony gathered at the edges of the set smile. Can you believe it? This privacy I had achieved. The plans I had for the future. To be swept aside because of a lot of old women and their birds. I examined the lease. I wrote offering a huge sum to buy it. They refused. So I studied these birds. I found out about their habits, and suddenly the solution was there, and it was easy. Man had always been the worst predator on these birds. Spoonbills are extremely shy. They frighten easily. I sent to Florida for a marsh buggy, the vehicle that is used for oil prospecting that will cover any kind of terrain. I adapted it to frighten and to burn. Not only birds, but humans as well, for the wardens would have to go too. And one night in December, my marsh buggy howled off across the lake. It smashed the camp. Both wardens were reported killed, though one, it turned out, escaped to die in Jamaica. It burned the nesting places. It spread terror among the birds. Complete success. Hysteria spread among the spoonbills. They died in thousands. But then I get a demand for a plane to land on my airstrip. There was to be an investigation. I decide to agree. It seemed wiser. An accident is arranged. A lorry goes out of control down the airstrip as the plane is coming in. The plane is destroyed. All signs of the lorry are removed. The bodies are reverently placed in coffins, and I report the tragedy. As I expected, there is further investigation. A destroyer arrives. I receive the captain courteously. He and his officers are brought round by sea and then led inland. They are shown the remains of the camp. My men suggest that the wardens went mad with loneliness and fought each other. The survivor set fire to the camp and escaped in his fishing canoe. The airstrip is examined. My men report that the plane was coming in too fast. The tires must have burst on impact. The bodies are handed over. It is very sad. The officers are satisfied. The ship leaves. Peace reigns again. Dr. No coughed delicately. He looked from Bond to the girl and back again. And that, my friends, is my story, or rather the first chapter of what I am confident will be a long and interesting tale. Privacy has been re-established. There are now no roseate spoonbills, so there will be no wardens. No doubt the Audubon Society will decide to accept my offer for the rest of their lease. No matter. If they start their puny operations again, other misfortunes will befall them. This has been a warning to me. There will be no more interference.
Interesting, said Bond. An interesting case history. So that was why Strangways had to be removed. What did you do with him and his girl?
They are at the bottom of the Mona Reservoir. I sent three of my best men. I have a small but efficient machine in Jamaica. I need it. I have established a watch on the intelligence services in Jamaica and Cuba. It is necessary for my further operations. Your Mr. Strangways became suspicious and started ferreting about. Fortunately, by this time, the routines of this man were known to me. His death and the girl's were a simple matter of timing. I had hoped to deal with you with similar expedition. You were fortunate. But I knew what type of a man you were from the files at King's House. I guessed that the fly would come to the spider. I was ready for you, and when the canoe showed up on the radar screen, I knew you would not get away.
Bond said, "Your radar is not very efficient. There were two canoes. The one you saw was the girl's. I tell you, she had nothing to do with me."
"Then she is unfortunate. I happen to be needing a white woman for a small experiment. As we agreed earlier, Mr. Bond, one generally gets what one wants."
Bond looked thoughtfully at Dr. No.
He wondered if it was worthwhile even trying to make a dent in this impregnable man. Was it worth wasting breath by threatening or bluffing?
Bond had nothing but a miserable two of clubs up his sleeve. The thought of playing it almost bored him. Casually, indifferently, he threw it down.
"Then you're out of luck, Dr. No. You are now a file in London. My thoughts on this case, the evidence of the poisoned fruit and the centipede and the crashed motor car, are on record. So are the names of Miss Chung and Miss Tarrow. Instructions were left with someone in Jamaica that my report should be opened and acted upon if I failed to return from Crab Key within 3 days.
Bond paused. The face of Dr. No was impassive. Neither the eyes nor the mouth had flickered. The jugular vein throbbed evenly. Bond bent forward. He said softly, "But because of the girl, and only because of her, Dr. No, I will strike a bargain. In exchange for our safe return to Jamaica, you may have a week's start. You may take your aeroplane and your packet of stamps and try to get away."
Bond sat back.
"Any interest, Dr. No?"
Chapter 16. Horizons of Agony. A voice behind Bond said quietly, "Dinner is served." Bond swung round. It was the bodyguard. Beside him was another man who might have been his twin. They stood there, two stocky barrels of muscle, their hands buried in the sleeves of their kimonos, and looked over Bond's head at Dr. No.
"Ah! 9 o'clock already."
Dr. No rose slowly to his feet.
"Come alone. We can continue our conversation in more intimate surroundings. It is kind of you both to have listened to me with such exemplary patience. I hope the modesty of my cuisine and my cellar will not prove a further imposition."
Double doors stood open in the wall behind the two white-jacketed men. Bond and the girl followed Dr. No through into a small octagonal mahogany-panelled room, lit by a central chandelier in silver, with storm glasses round the candles. Beneath it was a round mahogany table laid for three. Silver and glass twinkled warmly. The plain dark blue carpet was luxuriously deep. Dr. No took the centre high-backed chair and bowed the girl into the chair on his right. They sat down and unfolded napkins of white silk. The hollow ceremony and the charming room maddened Bond. He longed to break it up with his own hands, to wind his silk napkin round Dr. No's throat and squeeze until the contact lenses popped out of the black, damnable eyes. The two guards wore white cotton gloves. They served the food with a suave efficiency that was prompted by an occasional word in Chinese from Dr. No. At first, Dr. No seemed preoccupied. He slowly ate through three bowls of different soup, feeding himself with a spoon with a short handle that fitted neatly between the pincers. Bond concentrated on hiding his fears from the girl. He sat relaxed and ate and drank with a forced good appetite. He talked cheerfully to the girl about Jamaica, about the birds and the animals and the flowers, which were an easy topic for her. Occasionally his feet felt for hers under the table. She became almost gay. Bond thought they were putting on an excellent imitation of an engaged couple being given dinner by a detested uncle. Bond had no idea if his thin bluff had worked. He didn't give much for their chances. Dr. No and Dr. No's story exuded impregnability. The incredible biography rang true. Not a word of it was impossible. Perhaps there were other people in the world with their private kingdoms, away from the beaten track, where there were no witnesses, where they could do what they liked. And what did Dr. No plan to do next, after he had squashed the flies that had come to annoy him? And if, when, he killed Bond and the girl, would London pick up the threads that Bond had picked up? Probably they would. There would be Plydell Smith, the evidence of the poisoned fruit. But where would Bond's replacement get with Dr. No? Not far. Dr. No would shrug his shoulders over the disappearance of Bond and Quarrel, never heard of them, and there would be no link with the girl. In Morgan's Harbour they would think she had been drowned on one of her expeditions. It was hard to see what could interfere with Dr. No, with the second chapter of his life, whatever it was. Underneath his chatter with the girl, Bond prepared for the worst. There were plenty of weapons beside his plate. When the cutlets came, perfectly cooked, Bond fiddled indecisively with the knives and chose the bread knife to eat them with. While he ate and talked, he edged the big steel meat knife towards him. An expansive gesture of his right hand knocked over his glass of champagne, and in the split second of the crash his left hand flicked the knife into the deep sleeve of his kimono. In the midst of Bond's apologies and the confusion as he and the bodyguard mopped up the spilled champagne, Bond raised his left arm and felt the knife slip back to below his armpit, and then fall inside the kimono against his ribs. When he had finished his cutlets, he tightened the silk belt round his waist, shifting the knife across his stomach. The knife nestled comfortingly against his skin, and gradually the steel grew warm. Coffee came, and the meal was ended. The two guards came and stood close behind Bond's chair and the girl's. They stood with their arms crossed on their chests, impassive, motionless, like executioners. Dr. No put his cup softly down on his saucer. He laid his two steel claws down on the table in front of him. He sat a fraction more upright. He turned his body an inch in Bond's direction. Now there was no preoccupation in his face. The eyes were hard and erect, the thin mouth creased and opened. "You have enjoyed your dinner, Mr. Bond." Bond took a cigarette from the silver box in front of him and lit it. He played with the silver table lighter. He smelled bad news coming. He must somehow pocket the lighter. Fire might perhaps be another weapon. He said easily, "Yes, it was excellent." He looked across at the girl. He leant forward in his chair and rested his forearms on the table. He crossed them, enveloping the lighter. He smiled at her. "I hope I ordered what you like."
"Oh, yes, it was lovely."
For her, the party was still going on. Bond smoked busily, agitating his hands and forearms to create an atmosphere of movement. He turned to Dr. No. He stubbed out his cigarette and sat back in his chair. He folded his arms across his chest. The lighter was in his left armpit. He smiled cheerfully. "And what happens now, Dr. No?"
"We can proceed to our after-dinner entertainment, Mr. Bond."
The thin smile creased and vanished.
"I have examined your proposition from every angle. I do not accept it."
Bond shrugged his shoulders. "You are unwise."
"No, Mr. Bond. I suspect that your proposition is a gold brick. People in your trade do not behave as you suggest. They make routine reports to their headquarters. They keep their chief aware of the progress of their investigations. I know these things. Secret agents do not behave as you suggest you have done. You have been reading too many novels of suspense. Your little speech reeked of grease paint and cardboard. No, Mr. Bond, I do not accept your story. If it is true, I am prepared to face the consequences. I have too much at stake to be turned from my path. So the police come. The soldiers come. Where are a man and a girl? What man and what girl? I know nothing. Please go away. You are disturbing my guanera. Where is your evidence, your search warrant? The English law is strict, gentlemen." Go home and leave me in peace with my beloved cormorants. You see, Mr. Bond? And let us even say that the worst comes to the worst, that one of my agents talks, which is highly improbable.
Bond remembered the fortitude of Miss Chung.
What have I to lose? Two more deaths on the charge sheet. But, Mr. Bond, a man can only be hanged once.
The tall, pear-shaped head shook gently from side to side.
Have you anything else to say? Any questions to ask? You both have a busy night ahead of you. Your time is getting short, and I must get my sleep. The monthly ship is putting in tomorrow, and I have the loading to supervise. I shall have to spend the whole day down on the quay. Well, Mr. Bond?
Bond looked across at the girl. She had gone deathly pale. She was gazing at him, waiting for the miracle he would work. He looked down at his hands. He examined his nails carefully. He said, playing for time, "And then what? After your busy day with the bird dung, what comes next on your program? What is the next chapter you think you're going to write?"
Bond didn't look up. The deep, quiet, authoritative voice came to him as if it was coming down from the night sky.
"Ah, yes. You must have been wondering, Mr. Bond. You have the habit of inquiry. It persists even to the last, even into the shadows. I admire such qualities in a man with only a few hours to live. So I will tell you. I will turn over the next page. It will console you. There is more to this place than bird dung. Your instincts did not betray you."
Dr. No paused for emphasis.
"This island, Mr. Bond, is about to be developed into the most valuable technical intelligence center in the world."
"Really?"
Bond kept his eyes bent on his hands.
"Doubtless you know that Turk's Island, about 300 miles from here, through the Windward Passage, is the most important center for testing the guided missiles of the United States."
"It is an important center, yes."
"Perhaps you have read of the rockets that have been going astray recently, the multi-stage Snark, for instance, that ended its flight in the forests of Brazil instead of the depths of the South Atlantic."
"Yes."
"You recall that it refused to obey the telemetry instructions to change its course, even to destroy itself? It developed a will of its own?"
"I remember."
"There have been other failures, decisive failures, from the long list of prototypes, the Zuni, Matador, Petrel, Regulus, Bomark, so many names, so many changes I can't even remember them all." "Well, Mr. Bond,"
Dr. No could not keep a note of pride out of his voice,
"it may interest you to know that the vast majority of these failures have been caused from Crab Key."
"Is that so?"
"You do not believe me? No matter. Others do. Others who have seen the complete abandonment of one series, the Mastodon, because of its recurring navigational errors, its failure to obey the radio directions from Turk's Island. Those others are the Russians. The Russians are my partners in this venture. They trained 6 of my men, Mr. Bond. 2 of those men are on watch at this moment, watching the radio frequencies, the beams on which these weapons travel. There is $1 million worth of equipment up above us in the rock galleries, Mr. Bond, sending fingers up into the heaviside layer, waiting for the signals, jamming them, countering beams with other beams. And from time to time, a rocket soars up on its way 100, 500 miles into the Atlantic. And we track it, as accurately as they are tracking it in the operations room on Turk's Island. Then, suddenly, our pulses go out to the rocket. Its brain is confused. It goes mad. It plunges into the sea. It destroys itself. It roars off at a tangent. Another test has failed. The operators are blamed. The designers. The manufacturers. There is panic in the Pentagon. Something else must be tried. Different frequencies, different metals, a different radio brain."
"Of course." Dr. No was fair.
"We, too, have our difficulties. We track many practice shoots without being able to get through to the brain of the new rocket. But then we communicate urgently with Moscow. Yes, they have even given us a cipher machine with our own frequencies and routines. And the Russians get thinking. They make suggestions. We try them out. And then one day, Mr. Bond, it is like catching the attention of a man in a crowd. Up in the stratosphere, the rocket acknowledges our signal. We are recognized, and we can speak to it and change its mind."
Dr. No paused.
Do you not find that interesting, Mr. Bond? This little sideline to my business in Guano? It is, I assure you, most profitable. It might be still more so. Perhaps Communist China will pay more. Who knows? I already have my feelers out.
Bond lifted his eyes. He looked thoughtfully at Dr. No. So he had been right. There had been more, much more in all this than met the eye. This was a big game, a game that explained everything, a game that was certainly, in the international espionage market, well worth the candle. Well, well. Now the pieces in the puzzle fell firmly into place. For this it was certainly worth scaring away a few birds and wiping out a few people. Privacy? Of course Dr. No would have to kill him and the girl. Power? This was it. Dr. No had really got himself into business. Bond looked into the two black holes with a new respect. He said, "You'll have to kill a lot more people to keep this thing in your hands, Dr. No. It's worth a lot of money. You've got a good property here, a better one than I thought. People are going to want to cut themselves a piece of this cake. I wonder who will get to you first and kill you. Those men up there?" He gestured towards the ceiling. "Who were trained in Moscow? They're the technicians. I wonder what Moscow is telling them to do. You wouldn't know that, would you?" Dr. No said, "You persist in underestimating me, Mr. Bond. You are an obstinate man, and stupider than I had expected. I am aware of these possibilities. I have taken one of these men and made him into a private monitor. He has duplicates of the ciphers and of the cipher machine. He lives in another part of the mountain. The others think that he died. He watches on all the routine times. He gives me a second copy of all the traffic that passes. So far, the signals from Moscow have been innocent of any sign of conspiracy. I am thinking of these things constantly, Mr. Bond. I take precautions, and I shall take further precautions. As I said, you underestimate me."
"I don't underestimate you, Dr. No. You're a very careful man. But you've got too many files open on you. In my line of business, the same thing applies to me. I know the feeling. But you've got some really bad ones. The Chinese one, for instance, I wouldn't like to have that one. The FBI should be the least painful, robbery and false identity. But do you know the Russians as well as I do? You're a best friend at the moment. But the Russians don't have partners. They'll want to take you over, buy you out with a bullet. Then there's the file you've started with my service. You really want me to make that one fatter? I shouldn't do it if I were you, Dr. No. They're a tenacious lot of people in my service. If anything happens to me and the girl, you'll find Crab Key's a very small and naked little island." "You cannot play for high stakes without taking risks, Mr. Bond. I accept the dangers, and so far as I can, I have equipped myself against them. You see, Mr. Bond," the deep voice held a hint of greed, "I am on the edge of still greater things. The Chapter 2 to which I referred holds the promise of prizes which no one but a fool would throw away because he was afraid. I have told you that I can bend the beams on which these rockets fly, Mr. Bond. I can make them change course and ignore their radio control. What would you say, Mr. Bond, if I could go further? If I could bring them down into the sea near this island and salvage the secrets of their construction? At present, American destroyers far out in the South Atlantic salvage these missiles when they come to the end of their fuel and parachute down into the sea. Sometimes the parachutes fail to open. Sometimes the self-destruction devices fail to operate. No one on Turk's Island would be surprised if every now and then the prototype of a new series broke off its flight and came down near Crab Key. To begin with, at least, it would be put down to mechanical failure. Later, perhaps, they would discover that other radio signals besides theirs were guiding their rockets. A jamming war would start. They would try and locate the origin of the false signals. Directly I found they were looking for me, I would have one last fling. Their rockets would go mad. They would land on Havana, on Kingston. They would turn round and home on Miami. Even without warheads, Mr. Bond, 5 tons of metal arriving at 1,000 miles an hour can cause plenty of damage in a crowded town. And then what? There would be panic, a public outcry. The experiments would have to cease. The Turks Island base would have to close down. And how much would Russia pay for that to happen, Mr. Bond? And how much for each of the prototypes I captured for them? Shall we say $10 million for the whole operation? 20 million? It would be a priceless victory in the armaments race. I could name my figure. Don't you agree, Mr. Bond? And don't you agree that these considerations make your arguments and threats seem rather puny?"
Bond said nothing. There was nothing to say. Suddenly he was back in the quiet room high up above Regent's Park. He could hear the rain slashing softly against the window, and M's voice, impatient, sarcastic, saying,
"Oh, some damned business about birds. Holiday in the sun'll do you good. Routine inquiry."
And he, Bond, had taken a canoe, and a fisherman, and a picnic lunch, and had gone off, how many days, how many weeks ago, to have a look. Well, he had had his look into Pandora's box. He had found out the answers, been told the secrets. And now? Now he was going to be politely shown the way to his grave, taking the secrets with him, and the waif he had picked up and dragged along with him on his lunatic adventure. The bitterness inside Bond came up into his mouth, so that for a moment he thought he was going to retch. He reached for his champagne and emptied the glass. He said harshly,
"All right, Dr. No. Now let's get on with the cabaret. What's the program? Knife? Bullet? Poison? Rope? But make it quick. I've seen enough of you."
Dr. No's lips compressed into a thin purple line. The eyes were hard as onyx under the billiard-ball forehead and skull. The polite mask had gone. The Grand Inquisitor sat in the high-backed chair. The hour that struck for the peine forte et dure. Dr. No spoke a word, and the two guards took a step forward and held the two victims above the elbows, forcing their arms back against the sides of their chairs. There was no resistance. Bond concentrated on holding the lighter in his armpit. The white-gloved hands on his biceps felt like steel bands. He smiled across at the girl. "I'm sorry about this, honey. I'm afraid we're not going to be able to play together after all." The girl's eyes in the pale face were blue-black with fear. Her lips trembled. She said, "Will it hurt?"
"Silence!" Dr. No's voice was the crack of a whip. "Enough of this foolery! Of course it will hurt! I am interested in pain. I am also interested in finding out how much the human body can endure. From time to time I make experiments on those of my people who have to be punished, and on trespassers like yourselves. You have both put me to a great deal of trouble. In exchange, I intend to put you to a great deal of pain. I shall record the length of your endurance. The facts will be noted. One day my findings will be given to the world. Your deaths will have served the purposes of science. I never waste human material. The German experiments on live humans during the war were of great benefit to science. It is a year since I put a girl to death in the fashion I have chosen for you, woman. She was a negress. She lasted 3 hours. She died of terror. I have wanted a white girl for comparison. I was not surprised when your arrival was reported. I get what I want."
Dr. No sat back in his chair. His eyes were now fixed on the girl, watching her reactions. She stared back at him, half-hypnotized, like a bush mouse in front of a rattlesnake. Bond set his teeth.
"You are a Jamaican, so you will know what I am talking about. This island is called Crab Key. It is called by that name because it is infested with crabs, land crabs, what they call in Jamaica black crabs. You know them. They weigh about 1 pound each, and they are as big as saucers. At this time of year they come up in thousands from their holes near the shore and climb up towards the mountain. There, in the coral uplands, they go to ground again in holes in the rock and spawn their broods. They march up in armies of hundreds at a time. They march through everything and over everything. In Jamaica they go through houses that are in their path. They are like the lemmings of Norway. It is a compulsive migration."
Dr. No paused. He said softly, "But there is a difference. The crabs devour what they find in their path. And at present, woman, they are running. They are coming up the mountainside in their tens of thousands, great red and orange and black waves of them, scuttling and hurrying and scraping against the rock above us at this moment. And tonight, in the middle of their path, they are going to find the naked body of a woman pegged out, a banquet spread for them, and they will feel the warm body with their feeding pincers, and one will make the first incision with his fighting claws, and then...
There was a moan from the girl. Her head fell forward slackly onto her chest.
she had fainted. Bond's body heaved in his chair. A string of obscenities hissed out between his clenched teeth. The huge hands of the guard were like fire round his arms. He couldn't even move the chair legs on the floor. After a moment, he desisted. He waited for his voice to steady, then he said, with all the venom he could put into the words, "You bastard. You'll fry in hell for this." Dr. No smiled thinly. "Mr. Bond, I do not admit the existence of hell. Console yourself. Perhaps they will start at the throat or the heart. The movement of the pulse will attract them. Then it will not be long." He spoke a sentence in Chinese. The guard behind the girl's chair leant forward and plucked her bodily out of the chair as if she had been a child and slung the inert body over his shoulder. Between the dangling arms the hair fell down in a golden shower. The guard went to the door and opened it and went out, closing it noiselessly behind him. For a moment there was silence in the room. Bond thought only of the knife against his skin and of the lighter under his armpit. How much damage could he do with the two pieces of metal? Could he somehow get within range of Dr. No? Dr. No said quietly, "You said that power was an illusion, Mr. Bond. Do you change your mind? My power to select this particular death for the girl is surely not an illusion. However, let us proceed to the method of your departure. That also has its novel aspects. You see, Mr. Bond, I am interested in the anatomy of courage, in the power of the human body to endure. But how to measure human endurance, how to plot a graph of the will to survive, the tolerance of pain, the conquest of fear? I have given much thought to the problem, and I believe I have solved it. It is, of course, only a rough and ready method, and I shall learn by experience as more and more subjects are put to the test. I have prepared you for the experiment as best I could. I gave you a sedative so that your body should be rested, and I have fed you well so that you may be at full strength. Future, what shall I call them, patients, will have the same advantages. All will start equal in that respect. After that it will be a question of the individual's courage and powers of endurance." Dr. No paused, watching Bond's face. "You see, Mr. Bond, I have just finished constructing an obstacle race, an assault course against death. I will say no more about it, because the element of surprise is one of the constituents of fear. It is the unknown dangers that are the worst, that bear most heavily on the reserves of courage. And I flatter myself that the gauntlet you will run contains a rich assortment of the unexpected. It will be particularly interesting, Mr. Bond, that a man of your physical qualities is to be my first competitor. It will be most interesting to observe how far you get down the course I have devised. You shall put up a worthy target figure for future runners. I have high expectations of you. You shall go far. But when, as is inevitable, you have finally failed at an obstacle, your body will be recovered, and I shall most meticulously examine the physical state of your remains. The data will be recorded. You will be the first dot on a graph. Something of an honor, is it not, Mr. Bond?" Bond said nothing. What the hell did all this mean? What could this test consist of? Would it be possible to survive it? Could he conceivably escape from it and get to the girl before it was too late, even if it was only to kill her and save her from her torture? Silently, Bond gathered his reserves of courage, steeling his mind against the fear of the unknown that already had him by the throat, focusing his whole will on survival. Somehow, above all else, he must cling to his weapons. Dr. No rose and stepped away from his chair. He walked slowly to the door and turned. The menacing black holes looked back at Bond from just below the lintel of the door. The head was inclined a fraction. The purple lips creased back. "Run a good race for me, Mr. Bond. My thoughts, as they say, will be with you." Dr. No turned away, and the door closed softly behind the long, thin, gunmetal back. Chapter 17. The Long Scream. There was a man on the lift. The doors were open, waiting. James Bond, his arms still locked to his sides, was marched in. Now the dining room would be empty. How soon would the guards go back, start cleaning away the dinner, notice the missing things? The doors hissed shut. The lift man stood in front of the buttons so that Bond could not see which he had pressed. They were going up. Bond tried to estimate the distance. The lift sighed to a stop. The time seemed rather less than when he had come down with the girl. The doors opened onto an uncarpeted corridor with rough grey paint on the stone walls. It ran about 20 yards straight ahead.
"Hold it, Joe," said Bond's guard to the lift man. "Be right with you."
Bond was marched down the corridor past doors numbered with letters of the alphabet. There was a faint hum of machinery in the air, and behind one door Bond thought he could catch the crackle of radio static. It sounded as if they might be in the engine room of the Mountain. They came to the end door. It was marked with a black Q. It was ajar, and the guard pushed Bond into the door so that it swung open. Through the door was a grey-painted stone cell about 15 feet square. There was nothing in it except a wooden chair, on which lay, laundered and neatly folded, Bond's black canvas jeans and his blue shirt. The guard let go of Bond's arms. Bond turned and looked into the broad yellow face below the crinkly hair. There was a hint of curiosity and pleasure in the liquid brown eyes. The man stood holding the door handle. He said, "Well, this is it, bud. You're at the starting gate. You can either sit here and rot or find your way out onto the course. Happy landings." Bond thought it was just worth trying. He glanced past the guard to where the lift man was standing beside his open doors, watching them. He said softly, "How would you like to earn $10,000 guaranteed and a ticket to anywhere in the world?" He watched the man's face. The mouth spread in a wide grin to show brownish teeth worn to uneven points by years of chewing sugar cane. "Thanks, mister. I'd rather stay alive." The man made to close the door. Bond whispered urgently, "We could get out of here together." The thick lips sneered. The man said, "Shove it." The door shut with a solid click. Bond shrugged his shoulders. He gave the door a cursory glance. It was made of metal, and there was no handle on the inside. Bond didn't waste his shoulder on it. He went to the chair and sat down on the neat pile of his clothes and looked round the cell. The walls were entirely naked, except for a ventilation grill of thick wire in one corner, just below the ceiling. It was wider than his shoulders. It was obviously the way out into the assault course. The only other break in the walls was a thick glass porthole, no bigger than Bond's head, just above the door. Light from the corridor filtered through it into the cell. There was nothing else. It was no good wasting any more time. It would now be about 10:30. Outside, somewhere on the slope of the mountain, the girl would already be lying, waiting for the rattle of claws on the grey coral. Bond clenched his teeth at the thought of the pale body spread-eagled out there under the stars. Abruptly he stood up. What the hell was he doing, sitting still? Whatever lay on the other side of the wire grill, it was time to go. Bond took out his knife and the lighter and threw off the kimono. He dressed in the trousers and shirt and stowed the lighter in his hip pocket. He tried the edge of the knife with his thumb. It was very sharp. It would be better still if he could get a point on it. He knelt on the floor and began whittling the rounded end on the stone. After a precious quarter of an hour, he was satisfied. It was no stiletto, but it would serve to stab as well as cut. Bond put the knife between his teeth and set the chair below the grill and climbed onto it. The grill. Assuming he could tear it off its hinges, the frame of quarter-inch wire might straighten into a spear. That would make a third weapon. Bond reached up with crooked fingers. The next thing he knew was a searing pain up his arm and the crack of his head hitting the stone floor. He lay stunned with only the memory of a blue flash and the hiss and crackle of electricity to tell him what had hit him. Bond got to his knees and stayed there. He bent his head down and shook it slowly from side to side like a wounded animal. He noticed a smell of burning flesh. He lifted his right hand up to his eyes. There was the red smear of an open burn across the inside of his fingers. Seeing it brought the pain. Bond spat out a four-letter word. Slowly he got to his feet. He squinted up at the wire grill as if it might strike at him again, like a snake. Grimly he set the chair upright against the wall. He picked up his knife and cut a strip off the discarded kimono and tied it firmly across his fingers. Then he climbed up again onto the chair and looked at the grill. He was meant to get through it. The shock had been to soften him up, a taste of pain to come. Surely he had fused the blasted thing. Surely they would have switched off the current. He looked at it only for an instant, then the fingers of his left hand crooked and went straight up to the impersonal wire mesh. His fingers went through the wire rim and gripped. Nothing. Nothing at all. Just wire. Bond grunted. He felt his nerves slacken. He tugged at the wire. It gave an inch. He tugged again, and it came away in his hand and dangled down from two strands of copper flex that disappeared into the wall. Bond pulled the grill loose from the flex and got down from the chair. Yes, there was a join in the frame. He set to work unravelling the mesh. Then, using the chair as a hammer, he straightened the heavy wire. After 10 minutes, Bond had a crooked spear about 4 feet long. One end, where it had originally been cut by the pliers, was jagged. It would not pierce a man's clothes, but it would be good enough for the face and neck. By using all his strength and the crack at the bottom of the metal door, Bond turned the blunt end into a clumsy crook. He measured the wire against his leg. It was too long. He bent it double and slipped the spear down a trouser leg. Now it hung from his waistband to just above the knee. He went back to the chair and climbed up again and reached nervously for the edge of the ventilator shaft. There was no shock. Bond heaved up and through the opening and lay on his stomach, looking along the shaft. The shaft was about 4 inches wider than Bond's shoulders. It was circular and of polished metal. Bond reached for his lighter, blessing the inspiration that had made him take it, and flicked it on. Yes, zinc sheeting that looked new. The shaft stretched straight ahead, featureless except for the ridges where the sections of pipe joined. Bond put the lighter back in his pocket and snaked forward. It was easy going. Cool air from the ventilating system blew strongly in Bond's face. The air held no smell of the sea. It was the canned stuff that comes from an air-conditioning plant. Dr. No must have adapted one of the shafts to his purpose. What hazards had he built into it to test out his victims? They would be ingenious and painful, designed to reduce the resistance of the victim. At the winning post, so to speak, there would be the coup de grâce, if the victim ever got that far. It would be something conclusive, something from which there would be no escape, for there would be no prizes in this race except oblivion. An oblivion, thought Bond, he might be glad to win. Unless, of course, Dr. No had been just a bit too clever. Unless he had underestimated the will to survive. That, thought Bond, was his only hope. To try to survive the intervening hazards, to get through at least to the last ditch. There was a faint luminosity ahead. Bond approached it carefully, his senses questing in front of him like antennae. It grew brighter. It was the glint of light against the end of the lateral shaft. He went on until his head touched the metal. He twisted over on his back. Straight above him, at the top of 50 yards or so of vertical shaft, was a steady glimmer. It was like looking up a long gun barrel. Bond inched round the square bend and stood upright. So he was supposed to climb straight up this shining tube of metal without a foothold. Was it possible? Bond expanded his shoulders. Yes, they gripped the sides. His feet could also get a temporary purchase, though they would slip except where the ridges at the joints gave him an ounce of upward leverage. Bond shrugged his shoulders and kicked off his shoes. It was no good arguing. He would just have to try. 6 inches at a time, Bond's body began to worm up the shaft. Expand shoulders to grip the sides. Lift feet, lock knees. Force the feet outwards against the metal. And, as the feet slipped downwards with his weight, contract shoulders and raise them a few inches higher. Do it again and again. And again and again. Stop at each tiny bulge where the sections joined and use the millimetre of extra support to get some breath and measure the next lap. Otherwise, don't look up. Think only of the inches of metal that have to be conquered one by one. Don't worry about the glimmer of light that never grows brighter or nearer. Don't worry about losing your grip and falling to smash your ankles at the bottom of the shaft. Don't worry about cramp. Don't worry about your screaming muscles or the swelling bruises on your shoulders and the sides of your feet. Just take the silver inches as they come one by one and conquer them. But then the feet began to sweat and slip. Twice Bond lost a yard before his shoulders, scalding with the friction, could put on the brake. Finally, he had to stop altogether to let his sweat dry in the downward draft of air. He waited for a full 10 minutes, staring at his faint reflection in the polished metal, the face split in half by the knife between the teeth. Still, he refused to look up to see how much more there was. It might be too much to bear. Carefully, Bond wiped each foot against the trouser leg and began again. Now half Bond's mind was dreaming while the other half fought the battle. He wasn't even conscious of the strengthening breeze or the slowly brightening light. He saw himself as a wounded caterpillar crawling up a waste pipe towards the plug hole of a bath. What would he see when he got through the plug hole? A naked girl drying herself? A man shaving? Sunlight streaming through an open window into an empty bathroom? Bond's head bumped against something. The plug was in the plug hole. The shock of disappointment made him slip a yard before his shoulders got a fresh grip. Then he realized he was at the top. Now he noticed the bright light and the strong wind. Feverishly, but with a more desperate care, he heaved up again until his head touched. The wind was coming into his left ear. Cautiously, he turned his head. It was another lateral shaft. Above him, light was shining through a thick porthole. All he had to do was inch himself round and grip the edge of the new shaft, and somehow gather enough strength to heave himself in. Then he would be able to lie down. With an extra delicacy born of panic that something might now go wrong, that he might make a mistake and plummet back down the shaft to land in a crackle of bone, Bond, his breath steaming against the metal, carried out the manoeuvre and, with his last ounce of strength, jackknifed into the opening and crumpled full length on his face. Later, how much later, Bond's eyes opened and his body stirred. The cold had woken him from the fringe of total unconsciousness into which his body had plunged. Painfully he rolled over on his back, his feet and shoulders screaming at him, and lay gathering his wits and summoning more strength. He had no idea what time it was, or whereabouts he was inside the mountain. He lifted his head and looked back at the porthole above the yawning tube out of which he had come. The light was yellowish, and the glass looked thick. He remembered the porthole in room Q. There had been nothing breakable about that one, nor, he guessed, would there be here. Suddenly, behind the glass, he saw movement. As he watched, a pair of eyes materialized from behind the electric light bulb. They stopped and looked at him, the bulb making a yellow glass nose between them. They gazed incuriously at him, and then they were gone. Bond's lips snarled back from his teeth, so his progress was going to be observed, reported back to Dr. No. Bond said out loud, viciously, "Blank them all!" and turned sullenly back on his stomach. He raised his head and looked forward. The tunnel shimmered away into blackness. Come on. No good hanging about. He picked up his knife and put it back between his teeth and winced his way forward. Soon there was no more light. Bond stopped from time to time and used the lighter, but there was nothing but blackness ahead. The air began to get warmer in the shaft, and perhaps 50 yards further, definitely hot. There was the smell of heat in the air, metallic heat. Bond began to sweat. Soon his body was soaked, and he had to pause every few minutes to wipe his eyes. There came a right-hand turn in the shaft. Round it the metal of the big tube was hot against his skin. The smell of sweat was very strong. There came another right-angle turn. As soon as Bond's head got round, he quickly pulled out his lighter and lit it, and then snaked back and lay panting. Bitterly he examined the new hazard, probing it, cursing it. His light had flickered on discolored, oyster-hued zinc. The next hazard was to be heat. Bond groaned aloud. How could his bruised flesh stand up to that? How could he protect his skin from the metal? But there wasn't anything he could do about it. He could either go back, or stay where he was, or go on. There was no other decision to make, no other shift or excuse. There was one, and only one, grain of consolation. This would not be heat that would kill, only maim. This would not be the final killing ground, only one more test of how much he could take. Bond thought of the girl and of what she was going through. Oh, well, get on with it. Now, let's see. Bond took his knife and cut off the whole front of his shirt and sliced it into strips. The only hope was to put some wrapping round the parts of his body that would have to bear the brunt, his hands and his feet. His knees and elbows would have to get along with their single covering of cotton fabric. Wearily he set to work, cursing softly. Now he was ready. 1, 2, 3. Bond turned the corner and forged forward into the heat stench. Keep your naked stomach off the ground. Contract your shoulders. Hands, knees, toes. Hands, knees, toes. Faster, faster. Keep going fast, so that each touch on the ground is quickly taken over by the next. The knees were getting it worst, taking the bulk of Bond's weight. Now the padded hands were beginning to smoulder. There was a spark, and another one, and then a worm of red as the sparks began to run. The smoke from the stuff smarted in Bond's sweating eyes. God, he couldn't do any more. There was no air. His lungs were bursting. Now his two hands shed sparks as he thrust them forward. The stuff must be nearly gone. Then the flesh would burn. Bond lurched, and his bruised shoulder hit the metal. He screamed. He went on screaming, regularly, with each contact of hand or knee or toes. Now he was finished. Now it was the end. Now he would fall flat and slowly fry to death. No, he must drive on, screaming, until his flesh was burned to the bone. The skin must have already gone from the knees. In a moment the balls of his hands would meet the metal. Only the sweat running down his arms could be keeping the pads of stuff damp. Scream, scream, scream. It helps the pain. It tells you you're alive. Go on, go on. It can't be much longer. This isn't where you're supposed to die. You are still alive. Don't give up. You can't. Bond's right hand hit something that gave before it. There was a stream of ice-cold air. His other hand hit. Then his head. There was a tinny noise. Bond felt the lower edge of an asbestos baffle scrape down his back. He was through. He heard the baffle bang shut. His hands came up against solid wall. They quested to left and right. It was a right-angled bend. His body followed blindly round the corner. The cool air felt like daggers in his lungs. Gingerly he laid his fingers down on the metal. It was cold. With a groan, Bond fell on his face and lay still. Sometime later the pain revived him. Bond turned sluggishly over on his back. Vaguely he noticed the lighted porthole above him. Vaguely he took in the eyes gazing down on him. Then he let the black waves take him away again. Slowly, in the darkness, the blisters formed across the skin, and the bruised feet and shoulders stiffened. The sweat dried on the body and then on the rags of clothing, and the cool air soaked down into the overheated lungs and began its insidious work. But the heart beat on, strongly and regularly, inside the tortured envelope, and the healing sorceries of oxygen and rest pumped life back into the arteries and veins and recharged the nerves.
This book is continued on Disc 6.